Hello and welcome to The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-changing world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks. Now, it's a special edition of The Energy Gang we've got for you today because we're being hosted by New York University here in Manhattan, where we're taking part in the discussion on the elections of 2024 and what they're going to mean for the energy transition. To discuss that subject, I'm joined by our old friend Amy Myers Jaffe, who's the director of the Energy, Climate Justice and Sustainability Lab here at NYU. Hi, Amy, how are you?
I am great, and great to be hosting you here at NYU today. Ed, the Washington Square Park is just alive with spring, so good day to be visiting.
Thanks very much for hosting us here at NYU. And it's also a great pleasure to welcome a newcomer to the Energy Gang. Vijay Vaitheeswaran is the Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor at The Economist. That's a great title. What does that mean? What do you cover at The Economist?
Thanks. Great to be here. Long-time listener, first-time caller, as it were. I cover the energy industry, both the traditional oil and gas stuff as well as the new stuff. And that's really where the climate innovation piece of it comes in, looking at the energy transition, what's working, what's not, what's greenwashing, what's greenwishing, and trying to see how we can get to a better place.
Fantastic. Absolutely fascinating job and a great job you're doing there at The Economist. One of the things we always like to do with people coming on the show for the first time is talk to them a little bit about their careers in energy, how you first got interested in energy, how you got to the job that you've got now. What was your story then? What is your career in energy and what does that look like?
Well, as a journalist, and you will know this from your prior career, we are sometimes jack of all trades. And so in a long career at The Economist, I've done different things. Latin America, I was our China bureau chief. But an early job I had 20 years ago was covering energy, environment, and related topics like a nascent climate change beat that not too many people were overly interested in back then. But it suddenly turned out to be quite interesting.
And unlike a lot of journalists, you do also have a bit of a scientific background in education, don't you?
That's true. I have an engineering degree from MIT, so I tend to look at technology both with fascination but also skepticism. I've written several books, a couple of them on energy and the future of climate and so on, but the most recent one was on innovation called Need, Speed, and Greed. And I make the point that while most people conflate innovation with technology, invention, the shiny new object, in fact, it's really about connecting something new. It could be just an idea or it could be new technology, with creating value, something valuable in the marketplace. And that second part of it is actually the more important part of innovation. It's not the shiny object. It's what problem are you solving for people?
Yeah, that is a great point and it's a really interesting angle on innovation that I think a lot of people often miss. I have to admit, I've not read your book, but I'm going to check it out now I've heard about it. That sounds really interesting. Thanks very much also then for joining us today. So as I said, we're going to be talking today about the elections of 2024. Sometimes people call this the year of elections. I think it's something like 4 billion people around the world in more than 50 countries are going to have the right to vote this year. Some of them are going to be not very important elections. Some of them, incumbent governments will stay in power. Some of them are just formalities. But in some of them, there are very big issues at stake. And some of these election results could be very consequential, I think, and could have, in particular, significant implications for the global energy transition. As you look around the world, you think about these elections that we're having this year. Maybe, Vijay, start with you on this. Which elections are you looking at? What do you think is interesting and important that's happening in terms of the votes that a number of these countries are having?
So there are some important elections. I mean, there are a lot of topics that come up with these elections around the world. We can think about immigration or xenophobia, to put it in a different way. We could see a kind of backlash against globalization and a rise of industrial policy that's manifest in a number of places, a rise of authoritarian tendencies in a number of countries as well. Even though they're having democratic elections, in fact, we see an imperfect democracy on the rise. But for our conversation, energy and climate is important in a number of key countries. Ones that I look at a little bit closely, the UK, of course, The Economist is British. Climate is one of the top issues, has inserted itself, and more broadly in Europe as well. The European Union has important elections coming up in a couple of months. And across Europe, farmers are protesting. That's nothing new in Europe. Farmers often protest something or another, but now it's become explicitly linked with climate change policy, the European Green New Deal, and a certain kind of opportunism by conservative parties taking advantage of this, nativist parties, to say, this is a European bureaucratic overreach on climate. It's a plot against the ordinary working man and the farmer. And so we see the dynamics of how politics can take hold of the issue like climate. And in a number of countries, it generally is working as a backlash against climate policies. Although in some countries, we could see something different.
Absolutely. And I think that sense of a global backlash against climate policy is a really interesting question, one we're going to want to dig into in a bit more detail later on. Amy, what about you? Elections that you're particularly looking at?
Well, I look at it both from a climate perspective and also a geopolitical perspective. So whether or not there are free and fair elections in Venezuela could be a big jolt, both in terms of the oil market and also just in sort of general to this trend about U.S. policy and authoritarian regimes. Of course, the U.S. election is going to be a really pivotal election when it comes to climate. I also think when you look at the U.S. election, we can talk about what does that or not mean for U.S.-China relations, which have been sort of a building block for how to get global climate accords over the finish line. So a lot going on there. And we have, you know, big elections. We had a big election in Indonesia where climate policy was on the docket. We're having one come up in Mexico. So even in the global south, I think climate change is on the agenda as people vote.
And I've been building this year up a little bit, the year of elections, that phrase that you hear from people quite a bit. Been building it up to say this is a significant moment. It's an important year for the energy transition, potentially a pivot point in terms of the course of energy policy around the world, and therefore the process of decarbonization and the general effort to tackle climate change. Is it fair to think of this year as important in that way? Amy, what do you think?
I think so. I mean, a lot of that, I guess, is a little bit geographically centric because if you're an American, you see the United States as sort of very leading. And of course, if there's backlash in Europe, same thing, because the EU has been, you know, even maybe more forward-leaning than the United States. So if we have elections that either takes the U.S. or the EU and either dents the enthusiasm or even in the United States case takes us out of the equation, you know, I think that'd be pretty material to, you know, how do we move forward and at what pace? And then you have things like, you know, why did I look at the elections in Indonesia? Because you have these testing of what we call the just energy transition partnerships, where the United States and other allies offered Indonesia $20 billion in financing to do sustainable palm oil, to close down coal and so forth. And the election result really, you know, sort of like you said in your introduction, we have some governments where it's sort of a, maybe a different human being, but it's the continuation of a particular elite. And so Indonesia, it looks like it's going to be a continuation. But some people are speculating that maybe Prabowo is less climate oriented than other people who had run.
This is the new president
of Indonesia, yeah, right.
So what about you, Vijay? Do you think this is a kind of decisive year for the energy transition?
You know, you could argue that every year is a decisive year and equally no year is a decisive moment, because if we think of this as something of a transition, it's really a century-long transition, right? We like to think in terms of 2050 with the Paris Accord and goals and targets and net zero, but really over the course of the century, we have to get not only to net zero, we have to ultimately get to net negative. That's what the IPCC science says. In the second half of the century, we need to dramatically remove emissions that we have contributed into the atmosphere. And very recently, the head of the IPCC, Simon Steele, at the moment, the chief scientist heading the scientific body, made a very important speech at Chatham House where he said, we have 2 years to save the planet. 2 years, starting right now. That's all we have. And he said, you might think that's a melodramatic statement. And of course, he knew it was, but he was trying to gin up support and enthusiasm for countries to accelerate their ambitions with their national commitments that are part of the process of getting to the next UN COP summit in Baku and then further on in Brazil. And so in a sense, trying to set the agenda for accelerated ambition. And that window of ambition is tight. And if we have setbacks this year in a number of key countries, that would perhaps move the train a little bit off the tracks. But my view is to look at the longer term and say, this is an inexorable force long term. Sometimes we'll go slower, sometimes we'll go faster, but we're heading in that direction.
Yeah, so given that, how do you feel about that kind of rhetoric about 2 years to save the planet? So it seems to me it's pretty counterproductive a lot of the time, because 2 years will pass. We will not have saved the planet. We might have made progress. We might have headed in the right direction. There'll be innovation. There'll be new policy initiatives. Investment will have happened. Renewable energy will have grown and so on. The outlook will not have been transformed in 2 years. I can be reasonably confident of that. And so then you either look silly in having said we've only got 2 years left, or you just encourage people to think, well, it's all a waste of time. We're doomed anyway. Nothing we can do. We tried to save the planet and we failed. Therefore, further action is pointless. You see what I'm saying? I just feel like it is very often that type of rhetoric doesn't help.
Listen, I agree with you. I think that that's not the way to look at the world. But again, I'm an engineer by background. I tend to look at the systems approach. What's the long-term approach? What's the problem we're trying to solve? The problem is emissions, right? The planet doesn't care much about where it comes from or who emits it or what fuel you use or what conversion technologies. So I tend to look at outcomes and see how what's the most reasonable way pragmatic people can come together and get there in the most cost-efficient fashion. But I also understand people play different roles. So if you're an activist, why does the preacher preach to the choir? Because he or she wants the choir to sing. And that's what's going on here, right? So there are people who are pandering to their base to get them to be more animated. And one has to understand why in the last few months as the Biden administration, which I would argue has actually had a relatively balanced energy policy. It presided over the greatest expansion of U.S. oil output. America's a net oil exporter now, as well as the greatest climate change law passed in American history, but has been throwing a lot of sops to the environmental left and the progressive left in the form of an LNG ban, or pause, we should call it more properly, a ruling on green hydrogen that was quite aggressively green and which the industry is not happy with. These are election year panderings to the base to get them to vote so that there will be a second Biden administration that can protect the gains on climate of the first Biden administration. So these are tactics. I don't tend to fall for them, but I do think there's a danger that they will provoke a backlash themselves.
So listen, I think part of the real problem is, you know, speaking from a university, is if you make too strong a pronouncement, even if it's based on science, you have an entire young generation that's already kind of in a gloom, doom mindset. And actually, they don't have the historical perspective of someone like myself or Vijay, who remember when we were on a path to 4 to 6 degree warming, and now the IPCC, you know, worst case is 3.2, but good case is 2.5. So we're on a better path. And I think emphasizing that we've actually accomplished something, and that if we just tried a little bit harder and really had the political will to do that, we could actually get somewhere, to me, is a better thing. And I do think it's the reality.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. So, okay, given then that we're all in agreement, this is not the year that will either doom or save the planet. It is still the case, certainly, I think, though, that there are some very significant elections happening for climate, above all the US election. Particular features of the US, I think, are one that seems pretty finely balanced, right? I mean, the polls maybe give Republicans, former President Donald Trump, a slight edge, but it's close, clearly could go either way. And it is also the case that politics is very polarized in the US on issues of energy and climate, maybe more so than anywhere else in the world, certainly more so than anywhere else I can think of in the developed world. Not many places where you see such a stark difference between what one party wants and what the other party wants. And therefore, if you're having this kind of difference of opinion in the largest economy in the world, a country that's playing a very important role in addressing climate change globally, as you were saying, Vijay, not least because of the Inflation Reduction Act and everything that's kind of flowing from that in terms of support for low carbon energy, the direction the US takes is going to be very important, I think. I mean, what are your expectations? What do you see as kind of hanging in the balance in terms of how the US could go, depending on what the outcome of the election is? Amy, what do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty safe bet to say that if Donald Trump is elected president of the United States, that consumer tax credits for EVs or for electric heat pumps and things like that are going to go away.
Wind and solar as well, would you expect?
I mean, Donald Trump tends to speak against wind, but the reality is that he has a lot of support from the energy sector in the United States, from Texas and conservative states. Well, there was a moment when we thought Texas was a purple state, but maybe that moment has passed. But anyway, here's my point. What's industry's real point now? When rubber really meets the road, they were getting federal assistance to do hydrogen, which is, you know, you had that brilliant show with Michael Weber about the potential of natural hydrogen, which is a drilling and producing field, right? So does the industry want Donald Trump to redefine what counts as clean hydrogen for incentives, or do they want him to can the whole program? Because I think there's divisions in the U.S. industry on that. I think you have players that actually have committed a bit of capital to energy transition. I know everybody believes that it's total greenwashing, but you know, you do have players that have put some major capital investments down, but you have other players. When we're talking about Donald Trump, I think it's safe to name names. I mean, you've got Harold Hamm, who was a big supporter and bumper of Trump the first time around. I mean, he is adamant, you know, no wind and all these things are cockamamie and we've done a miracle by producing so much oil and gas in the United States and we need to stay the course. And he's written a book about the miracle. And, you know, so I think you have difference of opinion even within the energy sector itself when we're talking oil and gas. And then, of course, there are a lot of really important companies in the tech side and AI that have taken a real commitment toward either net zero or renewable energy and so forth. And I don't think they're going to change their posture. And so no matter who's president, they're going to be going that course. They're going to be lobbying for that course.
What do you think, Vijay? How would you expect it to play out in a second Trump administration?
I think we can look at Trump 1.0 as a little bit of a guide of what we could see in Trump 2.0, even the facts have changed in an important way. What we saw was a lot of lobbyists put in charge of various parts of the cabinet, so that we saw a go slow on environmental enforcement, for example, a slow release of any funding that was supposed to be given. And so we're going to see some of that for sure. That's within the power of a new administration to do that. Ideologically, that's where they are. But the more grandiose ambitions, you know, there's an 850-page plus document put together by the Heritage Foundation with the wish list. They're probably not going to be able to get all that through, even if there is a trifecta that is both the House, the Senate, as well as the White House goes the GOP way. There's another part of the American body politic, the elephant in the room, which is industry lobbies, right? Very powerful and important. And
in states. States have independent policies.
States. Well, the states can be a reaction to it. But in terms of actually shaping the policy, a lot of the money that the Biden policies, particularly the IRA, but also the bipartisan infrastructure law, send money to our red states. It's been well documented. The lion's share of that money goes to companies in red-blooded states like Texas, Louisiana, and other parts where we happen to have lots of resources, both wind and solar, but also potential
but
for
also
hydrogen, CCS.
Ohio, you've got a lot
Absolutely.
Of Ohio,
That's
the,
right.
the, you know, the mid-Atlantic
and they
states.
Will fight. They will fight for, and I've spoke with a number of lobbyists at a recent energy conference we're all at, CERAWeek, and they made it very clear. They will fight tooth and nail, said a very prominent lobbyist for oil and gas, for most parts of the IRA law, not that stuff on EVs, but everything else we will go to the wall for was the phraseology. And there are more than 80 projects in the Gulf Coast region worth $1 billion or more related to hydrogen, CCS, and other aspects of things that get tax subsidies from the U.S. taxpayer. Mostly, those are very red states. So I think the policy is not going to change that much in those areas.
Let me make another point, though. I agree with Vijay 100%, right? Because there's just a lot of benefit at stake. And these guys are active in politics in Washington. So the question really then also is, though, because one of the things that determines how well we do in the climate negotiations is the relationship between the United States and China. And even though people are willing or thinking in their gut, oh, Trump was bad for Chinese relations and he had all this rhetoric and so forth, the reality is that President Biden and his administration has really turned the screws. So they didn't just have some grain issues, grain trade issues, or what's the deficit in trade balance and solar panel of that things. I mean, the Biden administration has gone whole hog in on the semiconductor issue, on dual-use technologies, on constraining China's access to American technology. And that has, in my opinion, actually worsened our relationship with China in a way that even hadn't happened yet during the Trump years.
So how would you explain that?
So from a point of view of climate, if Biden is reelected and the Chinese government feels that, you know, this is bad for the Chinese economy and they can't work with this administration because of all these trade restrictions and tariffs and penalties, then it makes it that much harder to get China and the United States to cooperate, Azerbaijan and in Brazil.
That is very interesting. And actually, we've heard some indications, not clear really yet how much weight we should put on them, but there have been some indications from former President Trump that he might be thawing in his attitude to China. He talked about welcoming investment from Chinese companies to make vehicles, EVs, or other kinds of vehicles in the US. I saw there was a story just breaking today about one of the big donors to Donald Trump saying the US shouldn't try and decouple its economy completely from China and they should keep trade links open and so on. So, yeah, that's an interesting aspect
to the story. Just thinking about it, it's a little bit counterintuitive because we think of the Democrats as being globalist and pro-trade. But really, and I think there's, you know, support for it on both sides of the aisle. There's been this concern about China and AI, about the risk to manufacturing of semiconductors, about sole sourcing of different minerals processing and so forth. I just think that the Biden administration and even the IRA itself has been very targeted. I mean, in the end, that policy made it very hard for Ford to consider going forward with the joint venture with CATL. So it's not been as glamorous a relationship as maybe people remember a little wistfully during the Obama years when we had the movement towards the Paris Accord and all this cooperation between the United States and China on climate.
I think that we can look to history. I also want to wait and see what Trump actually does if he were to be reelected. Let's see. I don't take anything said in a Truth Social posting to be a determination of future policy. But Ronald Reagan introduced the so-called voluntary restraints that, in effect, forced the Japanese automakers to build their plants in the American South. And this was a very conservative president, quite hostile to the rise of Japan, but ultimately created a renaissance of the American auto industry through the Japanese coming here. And so it is possible to imagine whoever wins, a good outcome for the climate would be a welcoming in of Chinese investment, you know, carefully scrutinized for malicious software and so on by American inspectors on American soil. But it's very hard to argue that a BYD car made in Tennessee by American workers supervised by the FBI is a spyware. You know, we can take care of that. But the basic idea of an interconnected global economy where we can, you know, we can produce climate innovations at the least cost possible, we surely that's the world we want to be in if we have climate ambition. The thing that the IPCC chair got right, despite the alarmism of his tone, is that we are far behind where we need to be in terms of levels of investment going into climate-related technologies. We need to dramatically escalate that investment and ambition. And putting in industrial policies and protectionist barriers that raise the cost of making clean technologies is a ridiculous approach. It's the opposite of what we should be doing.
Okay, so it's ridiculous economically, clearly, and I absolutely see the argument
and
there.
And from climate ambition, that is, of scaling up technologies affordably.
But you know, then when you look at the TikTok issue, it's like, do you want China to be able to collect data on everything people are doing in their homes, everything they're saying, every place they're going with their vehicle, all this different data? And then are you sure that relations wouldn't sour on some other issue down the road? And having that country have all this data would be a problem. I think that's really...
I mean, you're the expert. You wrote a wonderful book about the future of digital and energy.
Right.
And so you can tell us, is it possible to make cars in America at American factories, whoever the financial investors are, Chinese or Volkswagen or anybody else, and make sure that your car isn't sending that information back to the Chinese Communist Party?
So the question is, yes, but...
There you go.
It's the but. So how do I ensure that that does not actually happen, right? And some of that is my cyber policy. Some of that's a privacy issues. And I do think that the debate in Congress now over TikTok really highlights that. Obviously, there's a way to have a social media platform like TikTok not send the data back to a government. But if you look at, and I mentioned this in my book, so thank you for bringing my book up, this question of how the Chinese use surveillance data and what they do to their own population and how the U.S. standards need to be really different and we need to assert what we do with data and how we protect data, same with EU and so forth. It's hard to navigate those issues when, you know, I'm the chairman of some company, but I report to a guy who also happens to have a position in the Chinese Communist Party, and he gives me a direct order. You know, am I worried about Congress or not? Is the United States, when the United States figures out that that's a problem, is it too late to act or it's not too late to act? How many people, I mean, now they don't allow you, if you work for the U.S. government and certain agencies, to have TikTok, right? I don't have TikTok, but, you know, it's like, there's this whole question of when did I let the thing out of the bag and when did I actually put the guardrails on? And it really is, I think, a complicated topic.
Okay, so I want to look at another aspect of this issue, which is this whole question of building a political coalition to support climate action. Again, going back to your point, as you say, it makes no economic sense at all for instance, the US to put up trade barriers to stop Chinese solar modules being imported, which is the position at the moment. I was looking at our latest data the other day. If you buy a solar module in China, you can get it for 11 cents a watt. If you buy one in the United States, it's about 40 cents a watt. So it's almost 4 times that price. If you let in a lot of low-cost Chinese solar panels, you could have faster growth in the solar industry. Solar power would be that much lower cost and more competitive. And that would be an unambiguously good thing for the US solar industry, development of solar power in the US. However, the reason the trade barriers are there and the reason you have all these tax credits and other incentives for domestic manufacturing in the Inflation Reduction Act is the Biden administration has taken the view that if we are going to take people with us in this transition, if we're going to cause economic disruption through the shift from higher carbon technologies towards lower carbon technologies, you have to give American voters a sense that there's something in it for them, and that thing is jobs, investment in manufacturing industry in particular, and prosperity, better lifestyles in the here and now, not a kind of a long-term benefit to the
climate. But Ed, I would take it past that. What did we learn during COVID? Let's put the Chinese system of government aside for a minute, okay? What we learned in COVID was that a single source supplier of anything, anywhere, can be a problem for reasons that we don't understand. You know, during Fukushima, it turned out that in and around Fukushima is where they actually produce the circuit boards for all of the refrigerators of a certain brand in the United States. And so after that catastrophe, you literally couldn't repair that kind of refrigerator. If you had it, you basically couldn't count on buying that refrigerator for several years because they had that one plant, right? So, you know, what's the lesson of that? The lesson of that is you have to have a diverse supply chain. And the problem with this whole question about Chinese overcapacity is when the Chinese have overcapacity, does that, by virtue of that overcapacity and their ability to keep costs low, does that mean that you can't have a diverse supply chain because they just knock other parties out of the market? Which, I mean, the United States used to be the leading manufacturer of solar panels. We had like multiple of the top 10 20 years ago or whatever it was. You know, First Solar still survived, but a lot of the other companies are gone. And witness now, all those companies are now top 10 are all mostly Chinese. And the point is, it's also like, you know, I'm electing the president of the United States. I'm not electing, you know, someone in another country. So I care about whether there are good paying jobs in the United States. And also, if we're going to have like a COVID thing and I have to be self-sufficient in certain things, you know, especially things that have strategic meaning like energy, I have to know that a certain amount of what we're going to be able to use is here.
So Vijay, what do you think about this? When you look at the numbers for what's been happening in terms of Chinese manufacturing capacity in these low-carbon energy technologies, they talk about the new three sectors as being particularly important for Chinese exports, that is solar modules, EVs, and lithium-ion batteries. And we're seeing this huge increase in capacity in all of these things. Just looking at the solar module numbers, at the end of 2022, China had the capacity to build 562 gigawatts of solar generation and solar panels per year. By the end of 2023, it was more than double that, at over a terawatt of solar modules that they could make. And I think demand during that year of 2023, or total installations of new solar capacity around the world, was something like 420 gigawatts. In other words, there was enough capacity in China alone to meet total global demand twice over. It's absolutely staggering. And that massive overcapacity is where you get these declines in price for these solar modules and where you're seeing it for batteries and other products as well. What's your view on them? Are you saying that we should just welcome this and we should accept this as a good thing for the energy transition and for the spread of low carbon energy around the world?
There's two responses to that. One is, taken at face value, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I say, we're living in a world in which the mega trend of our age, probably that of our children and grandchildren, is that of an unfolding climate catastrophe and concomitantly the need to meet the aspirations of developing countries for ever more use of energy, overwhelmingly fossil at this point. Let's remember, 80% of primary energy use is still from fossil fuels, right? And that transition, if it's not done with much more ambition and aggression, we are going to utterly fail, and people who are least able to respond, the poorest in the poorest parts of the world, will be the ones to suffer the most. China has produced a phenomenal amount of clean energy goods that are going to spill over. If, as the United States, we want not to have those benefit our economy, we want to make it ourselves, hurrah, let's do that. Let's have a decade or two decades of industrial policy where we'll make these things ourselves. Every small widget that goes into every small part of an electric car, battery, lithium that goes into our mining will be mined at home. We can try that. Brazil tried this kind of autarky with information technology policies in the 1980s. Europe tried industrial policy for several decades. Didn't work out so well. France even designated toy making as a strategic industry deserving of protection, just to give you an idea of how far these things go, right? But let's go for it. We'll have expensive energy in America. Our energy transition will be a lot slower. And those goods hopefully will flow to sub-Saharan Africa and other countries where they can be put to great use, frankly, where there's more solar potential than the north of Germany. So I welcome the Chinese to produce as much of clean energy for their own use, because they still use a lot of coal, for Indonesia, for other countries as well that will welcome it, and let those parts of the world that are rich, elite, effete, and have a different body politic pay for expensive clean energy and all the parts of the widgets they want to make at home, paying whatever price they want, if that's America. I shed a tear for our country's competitiveness, but that's okay. We can do that. I'm happy for the planet.
I don't know. I mean, I hear the logic, Vijay, behind what you're saying.
I've seen this bad movie before. I mean, I think we all have. Industrial policy doesn't work that well.
Well, you know what? You're absolutely wrong, because it's industrial policy that got China to be in this position in the first place. They just had a good industrial policy. In the past, Brazil's had a bad industrial policy. So the question is not so much this hard dichotomy. The question is, what is a good U.S. industrial policy, right? So, you know, we still...
On that, I would agree. Do you think we're on the right path? Do we have the right formula yet?
No, but I think that we're in a better place than we were 5 years ago, when we didn't have an industrial policy. And we still have something going for us, which is still true, which is that our ability to innovate, because we are a free country, quote unquote, right, is actually a lot stronger. You could still be somebody 25 years old in the garage and come up with a company that would someday put a major company out of business. That's still true today in the United States. Less true in places like China, where a lot of the money and assistance went to state enterprise or to favored companies. Even now, when it's becoming clear that certain countries, whether that's in Asia or here in the United States, might really make progress on solid state batteries that could be really revolutionary. You know, Ed's been a cynic, but anyway, the Chinese saw that and said, geez, we're not in that game. But if, you know, a South Korea or the U.S. or somebody else has a breakthrough in that and that becomes the state of play, we will be in a bad place, because we'll be this lithium-based economy that hasn't innovated. And so they literally ordered all their car companies to work together on solid state batteries, right? So I do think that the United States is still, frankly, today, aren't we like the strongest economy in the world? I mean, I got the deficit, so I had to like consider that in the back of my mind. But, you know, in the end, in terms of GDP and performance, we're doing better than China.
I mean, I'll double down on what you're saying. In fact, I would even make a prediction here. When the history of how the world dealt with climate change this century is written, many decades down the road, I think there's a pretty good chance it will be written that America helped invent the technologies and scale them that fundamentally solved the climate problem for the world. I think we have the greatest innovative capacity of any economy on Earth, bar none. There's no doubt about that. Where we've let ourselves down is we invented and let others scale. Germany subsidized solar panels on the roofs in a country with virtually no solar potential. The Chinese figured out how to amass capital at scale and bring these things to market in a very inexpensive way. If we're developing the market in America and the financing, the bridge financing to get from venture capital through the missing middle to the market and have the demand emerge for these things, then we will fundamentally transform these innovations, because we have them. You and I see them in the laboratories every day and the venture capitalists.
But we always let ourselves down
by not scaling them up. So if we can do that, which is what we're working on now, which what the IRA and infrastructure laws are about, that would be phenomenal. Where we would interfere with that and create an own goal is if we have distorting subsidies that misdirect investment. If we say half that money has got to go towards X, Y, and Z social policy, or how much are you putting in this particular other goal that's very important to society, but that's not related to invention, to scaling, to getting this to market in the most effective way, and we saddle these new young companies that have a lot of technology risk with other kinds of unnecessary risks as well. That's how we could end up with an own goal. But I'm with you on the idea that we're going in the right direction.
Listen, the history is, back when we called it ERA, which was the package to rescue us from the financial crisis in 2008-2009, the Loan Program Office put a lot of money in utility-scale solar. And people criticized it because it was like a one-note policy. Everybody focused on Solyndra, which was a failure. But the truth is, Those plants got built, they made money, and it paved the way for an entire generation of companies that make money doing utility scale solar and then move to other places. And now utility scale solar is commercial in many places.
And that program funded an obscure company known as Tesla as well.
Yeah, that too. Exactly. So we've been, you know, very successful, I think, long term, like you're saying, with industrial policy. So it's really just a question of, it's hard to know sitting here, you know, which of these things are going to hit and which of these things are going to be a misstep.
So you do have to try a large number of things, basically. I mean,
you do. You have to take a portfolio approach, because that's really what the VC community has learned. And we have really a premier VC community.
Yeah, that's very true. Sadly, we are unlikely, the three of us, to be able to gather here together at the end of the century to look back on it to see exactly how the climate problem was
Speak
tackled.
Speak for yourself, Ed. Take it with, like, bioengineering. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, but at the very least, we might be able to reconvene to look at how the US election panned out and what happened as a result of that. I do just want to look at some of these other elections around the world, though, because I know that we've been talking a bit about them, but there are some others that are quite important. Vijay, if the one or two that you wanted to highlight, what would you think that people should be looking at?
So it's interesting, if you look at the UK, which is actually a climate leader, has done quite a lot to decarbonize already, and in fact has institutionalized the process of dealing with climate. That is, no one government can radically change policy without having independent bodies, for example, check up on them and verify or not whether they're continuing with the decarbonization targets. So they're way ahead of many parts of the world. But at the moment, it is suiting the Conservative government, which is very likely to lose the next election to Labour, to demonize the Labour Party's position as radical. They want to take away your car, your gas boiler. They're going to shove heat pumps down your throat. And so this kind of easy sort of rhetoric, which frankly plays well. We saw it happen in Germany as well. There was a heat pump backlash. And I think that's the kind of thing that's being used as sort of political pandering. It might be effective, is the unfortunate thing, even if it's not closely connected to the facts of the case.
Because then similarly, we have these elections for the European Parliament in June in the EU. Now, the European Parliament's not, in its own right, a massively important institution. It can't pass legislation.
It's not, but it's a bellwether, right? That's where we saw the Green Deal come up, right? The so-called European Green Deal, as well as other climate forward strategies. Europe has led the world in many ways on all forms of decarbonization strategies. And this would send a signal of bureaucratic overreach, or eurocratic overreach in that example. The fact that farmers have come out across Europe, multiple countries, now the stories are a little different in every country, but broadly speaking, there's a political momentum, and people like Macron, very shrewd politician, has said, I'm with the farmers. In other words, it's forcing the elites to sort of come to a position where they may compromise their enthusiasm for climate policies. And I see this as really not just as an election issue, but it's a continuum coming from the European energy shock with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the gas price shock that Europe endured, a reminder that environmental policies alone are not enough. You have to think about the three legs of the energy stool: energy security and prices. And that's kind of the world we're in. And that's really the world that's challenging climate policy. And elections are just a prism through which we're looking at it.
And you were talking earlier about those right populist parties, you might call them, who tend to be anti-immigration. Those in general, as you were saying, are anti-climate action as well. Looks like they're going to make pretty significant gains in these parliamentary elections, right? I mean, they're going to become a bigger bloc.
It does look like
And as you say, it's a bellwether. That is a reflection of sentiment in general in Europe moving against more aggressive decarbonisation. I mean, one of the things you talk about, as you say, people don't like the idea of having low-carbon energy technologies rammed down their throats. The thing I was very struck by, I was looking at a poll the other day, a series of poll results about low-carbon technologies and public attitudes to them in Europe. The most unpopular policy by far was banning sales of internal combustion engine vehicles, gasoline-fueled, petrol-fueled, I guess, as we would call them in Britain. People don't like the idea of choice being taken away. I think that's something also which is quite resonant in the United States as well. The idea of being deprived of choice is something that people do tend to push back against. Do you think that groundswell of opinion then is likely to delay the shift to EVs in Europe?
Yes, is the short answer. There's no doubt. Without a forcing function of some kind of ban or a clear phase out, and one in which the date is locked, you will not see engine companies, which is basically what car companies are these days. They make engines and they outsource everything else to their tier one suppliers. They will not give up. And we've already seen a rearguard action among the German automakers to try to get so-called e-fuels and other forms of fuels that can keep that combustion technology going, because they're confident their lobbyists can push the date back and push the date back and push the date back. Unless there's a fundamental shift over to electrified transport, I think the end of oil will not be nigh.
E-fuels is a fantastic subject. I think one of my absolute pet hates, personally. I think the case for them seems so tenuous.
The case is very strong if you're an engine company and you want to keep engines in play.
I can see that. I see that point.
So one of the interesting things, I think, that goes back to our China discussion is car companies make these commitments to their platforms that they use for manufacturing on a decadal basis. So you have this high risk with the politics that China's going full steam ahead with EVs. They're going to have surplus capacity of EVs. They're building EVs in Hungary and other places. And they're starting to have good sales in places like Vietnam and other places in Southeast Asia with these cars. And what happens if there's a political backlash in Europe or in California, which is another place that was going to ban IC engine cars, and all of a sudden, you know, American car companies or European car companies get these mixed signals, they don't have a good strategy, and then, you know, what happens 10 years from now, the Chinese have just wiped them out, right? So I do think there's a lot of consequences to the politicization of this issue about the use case for this kind of car versus that kind of car, and, you know, the car companies are kind of tangled up in that. Could be a real problem for commerciality, not this year, not next year, but 10 years from now.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. I think it's always really interesting to think about Elon Musk's positioning in that context, where, again, looking at polling data, there's some interesting work on how support for EVs and willingness to buy an EV has become very polarized in the United States, and Democrats are much more likely to buy EVs than Republicans are. And so Elon Musk positioning himself very much as a Republican, supporting Republican ideas, getting close to Republican politicians, talking to former President Donald Trump the other day and saying that they had great agreement. I think it was Donald Trump who said, we agreed on just about everything, just disagreed on one little issue, which was electric vehicles. So it was quite funny. But anyway, point being, Elon Musk may be trying to do his bit to sort of depoliticize the issue of EVs to make it acceptable and popular among Republicans for them to own one as well. Not clear, though, how successful he's being with that.
Yeah, I don't think he's been too successful with that. I mean, I have to tell you, as an EV driver, I sometimes have this feeling on the road, do I have to worry that there's someone else on the road in a big, giant, you know, vehicle, and I'm in an EV, and so they have a polarized view of me as a driver, right? So, you know, we need to change that because, you know, they're great cars. And someday, if we don't change our attitudes, all that's going to happen is we're all going to be driving a cheap Chinese EV because they're going to be available. We'll have obliterated our own car companies, kind of what we did in the 80s by we produced big unfuel efficient cars, saying the Americans want unfuel efficient cars. And then all of a sudden, you know, we had an energy crisis and we wanted fuel efficient cars and everybody bought a Japanese car, right? So we really need to stay focused on, it's not my political view. It's where is the market going? Who's going to dominate that market? What cars are going to have a better package in terms of self-driving or at least corrective driving? What is actually the best technology? Which I think, you know, as a driver of an EV, I could see that if more people had them and we worked out the infrastructure problem, you know, they could be the superior technology.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. And as you say, I think it's really important for people to think about that history. Those who can't remember history are condemned to repeat it. I certainly think
the auto industry
could be a indicator of that. Any other elections around the world that you particularly think people should be thinking about?
So I'm looking at Mexico. Mexico is a really interesting election from a sort of energy point of view, because the incumbent candidate, Claudia Sheinbaum, who is running on the AMLO ticket, is a protege of López Obrador, the current president. He's been oil, oil, oil all the way, build new refineries, make us self-sufficient. But she is a climate scientist and actually an author of previous IPCC studies. So that sort of raises some interesting questions. She's going along with the party line, and she's talking about how state enterprise needs to be favored and needs to be in charge. And she's running against an opposition senator, Xochitl Galvez, who is saying the state oil company needs to reform. They need to do more renewables like geothermal. They need to close some refineries that are losing money. And, you know, which way the country goes could be pretty material. Some people are optimistic because they say with either candidate is more climate focused than Lopez Obrador. That might be true. But Mexico is way far away from its climate goals. They need to add something like 20,000 megawatts of renewables to reach their 2030 targets. They put in only 120 megawatts of solar in the last 5 years. So kind of a tough domain there. And then, you know, there's this whole, is Trump going to win? Because one of the things I think that people were afraid of in the past in Mexico was, what if there was a real conflict about the border issue? And the United States is a major supplier of energy to Mexico. 70% of Mexico's imports of natural gas come from the United States. We send a lot of gasoline. So that could become politicized in the Mexican context. So a lot at stake, I think, in this election and thinking about what Mexico's path forward is going to be.
Just sort of a broader thought, it's going to be easy to reach a conclusion that democracy is not great for climate action this year because of the ongoing green backlash, right? And in the short term, that may be true. But if we take the broader sweep of history, we remember that often there are reactions to these things. Amy previously alluded to local and state action after Trump pulled the U.S. out of the International Climate Accords and took some actions that were anti-climate. We saw American states, local and business communities, NGOs, come into a We Are Still In coalition, which actually saw accelerated action coming from the bottom up. If we look around the world, out of the 47 countries that don't have any kind of net zero commitments, 3/4 are in autocracies. Whereas if you look at the 25 countries that have legally binding net zero commitments, almost all are democracies. So I would say, you know, we can look to the bigger picture and say there's still hope.
That is fascinating. As you say, that's a very encouraging fact about the world, which, as you say, that kind of discourse about democracies will never vote for climate action in the long term. It's not as simple as that. So good to end on that optimistic note, because I think we do have to leave it there just about. Before we go, though, free electrons, personal items that we have brought in. Amy, what's yours?
So mine is, as you know, Ed, and Vijay, just getting you up to speed, I have been looking at in my own research on how geopolitics has raised its head in cross-border electricity trade. And it's sort of a stunning thing. First, we focused on oil geopolitics. Then I did a book on natural gas geopolitics, which, of course, became so prominent as a topic with the Ukraine conflict. What people don't really know much about is that the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, are still connected by wire to the Russian electricity grid. And that means that Russia itself controls frequency and voltage. And so more people are looking at this question of, if we're all trading electricity with each other the way Europe does it matter who's in charge of the hub that is sort of, you know, the control party? And so the Europeans are rushing to try to come up with a solution to, you know, Lithuania's put in battery farms. We're building interconnectors, you know, across to Finland and so forth. And I was sort of saying, well, the geopolitics is, you know, how does the United States provide NATO whatever is going to have to be to protect all these interconnections, you know, from possible attack or cyber protection and cyber assistance, right? But I really didn't think there was any possibility that we would lay a electricity wire from the United States to Europe to be able to sell our electricity across or never help us. I think mostly maybe it would be more like the United States would be sending it in case there was a problem in Europe. But ironically, some group did come up with a proposed project for a 3,300-mile subsea link from south of England to the U.S. Northeast. They're talking about NATO. They're saying $25 billion, a total of 12 gigawatts of multiple cables. People are talking about the geopolitics of having the United States be able to assist Europe with electricity and have that connection. So I'm even more timely on the topic than I thought, because I thought that would be impossible. And apparently it's not.
I think it's a fantastic idea. I think it's very exciting. I mean, when you think that we were laying transatlantic telegraph cables in the 19th century, whenever it was, 1860s, 1870s, doesn't seem crazy to think that in 150 years after that, we'd be able to lay power cables over that distance. I mean, not easy, I'm sure. Technically presents some challenges, but certainly, I think it's a really interesting idea.
Call me skeptical that NATO is already in trouble. President Trump has said he'll abolish it or walk out. This is now a new North Atlantic transmission organization that we're going to need. I'll believe it when I see it. Let's put it that way.
You cynic. No, I think I believe. Let's keep an eye on that one.
Keep an eye on it.
We'll keep an eye on it. You have been good at spotting trends, Amy. So
we'll see what comes next.
Nathan, what's your free leg from Vijay?
So I recently wrote a long special report for The Economist about the future of oil, the next 50 years, and what comes next.
Excellent report, yeah.
Thank you very much. And among the other things that came out of that was a very strong challenge from various quarters in the oil industry that didn't like the conclusion. But one good thing that came out of it is I've gotten an invitation to come and spend a week doing a deep examination of Saudi Aramco, of NEOM, and the various aspects of the Saudi strategy for hedging their risks for energy transition. And so I'll go in with eyes wide open. I'm headed there shortly, and will report to my readers on what I discover.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, Saudi Aramco, so interesting in so many ways as a company, just the scale of it, the technical skill of what they're doing. As you say, the way they think about strategy, the way they think about diversification. It should be a great trip. Yeah, very interested to hear from you after you've been on that, what you made of it. And it will be great to read about it all in The Economist. You're going to be writing it all up?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Look forward to reading that. So my free electron is a book I'm reading at the moment, which I started reading because I thought it sounded completely wrong. It's this book called The Price is Wrong by an academic called Brett Christophers, who's based in Sweden. And it's a book where the central thesis is that we can't get the energy transition at the pace we need because investment returns are too low in renewable energy. Therefore, you won't get the capital that's needed flowing into renewables. Therefore, governments need to take a much more active hands-on role in driving capital flows, in driving investment in order to get net zero on some kind of timetable that would be reasonable for achieving climate goals. As I say, this sounded kind of wrong to me when I heard about it because, I mean, it feels like one of the crucial reasons why returns are low in renewables right now is because so much capital is flowing into them. It's very competitive, right? A lot of companies want to invest in those sectors. The real problem, seems to me, is much more on the sort of the supply side of projects. There just aren't enough good, viable projects, enough viable technologies in low carbon energy for all the capital that's looking for a home. And so if you say, well, the returns are too low, therefore we're not getting all the capital there, it's like saying, no one goes there, it's too crowded. You know what? No one wants to live in New York because the rents are too high. So it seems like a contradiction in terms, but a lot of people are talking about this book and saying, seems really interesting, makes an interesting and provocative argument. So I've been taking a look and I'm only halfway through still, so reserve my final judgment, but it certainly makes some very good points, just as a primer on the way the power industry works and the way that investment flows work in energy at the moment. It's great at providing background on that. So well worth a read. As I say, I don't know that I'm going to be convinced, but I'm being won over a bit and certainly I'm less hostile than I was when I started reading it. And I can see why people have been talking about it and why it's something that people have been recommending.
Okay, well, I'm kind of agreeing with you, Ed, but I'll pick it up and see what I think, and we can discuss it on a future show.
I look forward to that, too. I certainly believe that we need fundamental reform in how electricity markets are governed,
how
we understand technologies like distributed energy resources, energy storage, how we regulate and allow and reward millions of cars that are going to be able to put power into the grid. So there's certainly reason to think we need some kind of reform in how incentives are structured. I don't know if this book gets it right, but I too will read it with interest.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. As you say, and that you might think of as perhaps the weak form of the argument and possibly one that's easier to defend. But anyway, yeah, I would love it if you read it and would definitely be keen to discuss it with you afterwards because it's certainly, as I say, it's a good read, a lot of good material in it, and certainly an interesting thesis. So unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. I know we're being called on to move on to the next stage of the debate, but it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks very much, Vijay, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Amy, for coming along again and for hosting us here at NYU.
My pleasure as always.
Thanks very much to our producer, Sam Nash, who is here in the room with us right now, and also to Debbie Biggins-Gilchrist, who was helping us out remotely. And above all, thanks very much to all of you for listening. As you know, we always value your feedback, so please do keep it coming. And we will be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views on what's next for the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.